Delighted that you're here. We have a good number present. We have visitors with us, and we're glad that you've come and hope you can come back and be with us on other occasions. What a tragedy it is when we read in the news about a child that is lost, or a child that comes up missing. And that news we recognize is devastating and a heartbreak to the parents and to the family and to those that know them, and there's tears and there's horror. Child is missing and a child is lost. We're all filled with sadness and helplessness, and perhaps the parents or those that are close may even have a guilt feeling. What did I do? What did I miss? What did I cause? What did I do to cause this to happen? Was I negligent? Child is now missing. And every effort's going to be made to find that missing child. We're looking for the child, and every effort is we're looking to the four corners of the earth trying to find the child. And all kinds of codes and alerts go out. We're looking for a missing child. It may be too late. We're wondering about that child. But I want to suggest to you it's equally as bad of losing our children to the world, if not more so. Losing our children to the world. See, these little children that we hold in our laps grow up and they become teenagers and young adults. And quite often, as they grow up and they were, quote, raised in the church, end quote, and as they're raised in the church, we took them to class and we thought we were training them, at least we were making an attempt in that direction. And the next thing you know, the children are not interested now in spiritual things. They may even quit going to church altogether. Their faith may get weak and it may fail and may falter. They may even become involved in immoral things. Like I never dreamed they would be involved in. We just lost our children to the world. And what I want to suggest to you is what happens here when they're young affects everything about what happens when they become young adults. And that's what we want to focus on in our study this morning. When those kind of things happen, we lose our children to the world, we're ready to point blame at other people, particularly the church. The church didn't provide enough for the young people. We lose our children to the world, they become disinterested in spiritual things, and consequently, it's really because the church didn't provide much for the young people. The classes didn't teach what they really needed. It didn't address what they were studying books of the Bible, and that's not really what they need to know. They need to know about other things. Or maybe we blame others because the services were boring. My children were bored and they weren't interested in spiritual things. And others didn't include them like they should have been included. And perhaps more could have been done to encourage them to do what's right. And some of that may be true. It very well may be services were boring and maybe others didn't include them and maybe classes didn't do their job. But I want to suggest to you the finger of blame needs not only be pointed in that direction, but in other directions as well. Let's start with this basic rule, and this is a proverb. By it being a proverb means it's a general rule to which there may be exceptions. We recognize that's the nature of proverbs. But here's the rule. The rule is train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old and not depart from it. When we deal with children in their youth, and as they're young, and as they're babes, and as they're toddlers, and beyond, that has everything to do with the kind of person they will be when they become old. Not only when they become teenagers and they become young adults, but even when they're aged themselves, what they are then has a lot to do with their training in their youth. Train a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. There are a number of examples in the Bible of God-fearing and dedicated young people. It is not true that the general run of young people among those that are supposedly raised in the church or raised by godly people are those interested in spiritual things, that they're never interested in spiritual things. Let's take Jesus himself. You remember in Luke chapter 2, at the age of 12, he went about his father's business, he said. He was God-fearing. He was dedicated. He was devoted. You take Daniel. Daniel was taken into captivity at 18 or 20 years of age as a young man. And yet he refused at that early age to be defiled by the king's delicacies. He refused, recognizing the king could take his head. And then later we read in chapter 6 that when he was an old man, he was praying daily, as was his custom since the early days. He'd been doing that for a long time. Daniel was a young man who was God-fearing and dedicated. David was a young man who, as he was challenging the giant, you remember that he was fearful of God and gave credit to God for the success. The Bible is filled with a number of people that were God-fearing. Timothy is another one. Timothy was reared by his mother and his grandmother, who were godly people. We'll say more about them a little bit later. In fact, in Philippians 2, Paul said concerning Timothy, he knows of no one that is like-minded. There's no one I have more confidence in than young Timothy. Timothy was a young man that was God-fearing and dedicated and devoted. And that's the kind of person you want your children to turn out to be. So let's talk this morning how we lose our children to the world. It is true sometimes. Maybe we're not teaching from the pulpit what we should. Maybe the Bible classes don't always accomplish what ought to be accomplished. Maybe we fail in encouraging young people. But the general rule, and that's what we're going by, Proverbs 22 says, it comes back to the home. So let's talk about how we lose our children to the world. What kind of factors does the Bible talk about that contribute to the failure of our children? Perhaps you are a young parent raising your children, or maybe yours are teenagers now, or maybe yours are already grown. But what is it that we need to be doing as young parents so that we can ensure our children don't turn out to the world, that they remain godly? How is it that we lose our children to the world? Here's the first thing I want us to consider. Quite often it's because they've not had enough corrective discipline. It's because quite often they've not had enough corrective discipline. Now let's get our Bibles out. If you don't have a Bible, perhaps you have an app on your phone. Let's get that out and let's follow some simple passages, starting with some things in the Old Testament. Let's go to the book of Proverbs, chapter 19. And as you're turning there, may I suggest to you that as a young parent, when my children were young, I found the most helpful book of all books that I ever read on parenting was the book of Proverbs. Nothing helped me any more as a parent than the book of Proverbs. If you're a young parent, spend some time in Proverbs. Read the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs will help you in the rearing and the raising of your children. Let's go to chapter 19 now and in verse 18. Let's talk about corrective discipline, wherein there is a problem, misbehavior in a child, and something needs to be done to correct that behavior. Let's start at chapter 19 and in verse 18. This text tells me it should begin early. Chasten their son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. What does it mean, while there is hope? While he still has hope, I believe the New Century said. In other words, while the child is still pliable, while the child can still be molded and shaped. You remember from James Dobson's book, There to Discipline, he suggested, and I've quoted many times, that a child's entire personality is developed by the age of 5. If we don't get hold of their behavior and have the child under some control by the age of 5, we may be hopeless and helpless in the rearing and the raising of our children. So you start and begin very early. Here's another principle. Same book. Let's go to the book of Proverbs. Let's go now to the 13th division and notice in verse 24. And that is, this discipline, corrective discipline, should be driven from love and because we care, not from anger. Notice verse 24, he that spares his rod hates his son, but he that loves him disciplines him promptly. You see, the one that says, I couldn't discipline my child, I couldn't spank my child because I love them too much. You really hate the child, the text says. If you really love them, you discipline them promptly because you care. Let's go again, same book. Same verse, in fact. Notice the text says you do that promptly. He that spares his son, or spares the rod, hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. What does this word promptly suggest? Strong suggests this word promptly means properly, to dawn, early at any task, with implication of earnestness, with painstaking. The King James translates that various ways. Betimes, in inquire, earlier to rise, seeking diligently. Here's some other translations that may help us with that. Now, the King James says, New King James, he that spares the son hates his, spares the rod hates his son, but he that loves him disciplines him promptly. The modern King James says, chastens him early, disciplines him diligently. In other words, he's prompt, he's very diligent, he sticks with it, he's consistent in the application of his discipline. Colin Daitlett says, it does not denote early morning of the day, but the morning of life. You start early, as we've already mentioned. The early the fruit, the better the training. A father who truly wishes his son well keeps him betimes under strict discipline to give him, while he is still capable of being influenced, the right direction, and to allow no errors to root themselves in him. But he who is indulgent toward his child when he ought to be strict acts as if he wished his ruined. Alan Dalitz said it correctly. Let's go to the 22nd chapter now. We're still in Proverbs. Proverbs 22 and in verse 15. This corrective discipline should correct the behavior. You are familiar with this proverb that foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. What does that mean? Children will misbehave. Children are going to act up. Children are going to disobey. They're going to do some things that they shouldn't do. But the rest of the text says, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. In other words, when applied consistently and properly, it's going to take care of that discipline problem. It's going to correct that misbehavior. So the discipline should correct the misbehavior. If I've been applying discipline and I'm not seeing any improvement, I might stop back and say, you know what, I may not be doing this right. Maybe I'm not consistent. Maybe I'm not firm enough. Maybe I'm not doing it as I should. But furthermore, still in Proverbs, let's go to the 23rd division. Proverbs 23, and I want us to notice in verses 13 and 14. That as we discipline the child, it should have their future in mind. It should have their future in mind. Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. It's not going to kill him. That's what the proverb says. But if you beat him with a rod, that's a switch, that's a spanking, you'll deliver his soul from hell, from Hades. In other words, you're thinking of the future, not just the immediate problem. We have a misbehavior problem. We corrected that. But really, it should be done in view of what they're going to become as teenagers, and then what they're going to become as young adults, and what they'll be in their older life. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 12. Let's go to a New Testament text this time. Go to the book of Hebrews chapter 12 and in verse 11. It talks about the chastening of the Lord in this context, which was persecution, and it compares it to the discipline that a parent gives to the child. You notice what it says at verse 11. He said, no chastening seems joyful at the present, but it's painful. No parent who ever disciplined the child enjoys that. The child doesn't enjoy it. It's painful. But afterward, it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who are trained by that. You can look back to your own raising and you recognize any discipline you had, you appreciate now because of the good that it accomplished. So it should be done in view of their future, what they're going to become. Now let's put ourselves to the test. Let's see how we're doing with that. Did your discipline begin early at a young age? That is, the discipline you give to your child. Did it begin early? Here's another question. Does your discipline correct and fix the problem? You say, no, it didn't. The problem's getting worse. Well, then I may need to reassess what I'm doing. Here's another question. Did you delay correction until a while after the offense? In other words, here was the misbehavior, and then you delayed that for a long time till the child doesn't really understand why they're being disciplined. Are you disciplining them promptly, as the text suggests? Do you react in anger, or is it driven by love? What was that spanking, because you were angry at the child or because you really love them and you're trying to correct their misbehavior and turn them into good citizens and faithful Christians? Here's another question. Are you thinking about the child's future? Are you thinking only of what they're doing right now? The embarrassment they caused you? Or is it you're thinking of what they'll be as teens and young adults? Do you warn your child and warn them and warn them and never follow through? You do that again, you're in trouble. You do that again and I'm going to get you. I'm telling you one more time and never follow through? Is a child learning something from that? While we lose our children to the world, one of the reasons is because there's not enough corrective discipline. Here's a second reason. Because of the poor example that they see. There are many children that are raised in a home, so-called by, and I put in quotations, Christians. If they learn some things there that they shouldn't be learning. You see, children learn from what parents do. The example that they set. Examples are powerful. I'm not going to take the time to read Matthew chapter 5. That's in the Sermon on the Mount. You remember where Jesus talked about the citizens of the kingdom and that they were like salt and they were like light. The point is that influence is powerful. Example is powerful. We understand that. Timothy learned from the example of his mother and his grandmother. That faith, it was first in his mother and in his grandmother, remember that? It is in you also. How powerful their example was. Children learn from what they see their parents do. Kings often become just like their dads in the Old Testament. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 22. Let's notice two examples, and they're just the opposite. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 22, if you will, and in verse 42 and 43. Jehoshaphat learned from Asa. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he became king. Look at verse 43. And he walked in all the ways of his father Asa and did not turn aside from them, doing what was right in the eyes of the Lord. In other words, he saw that in his father and he did the same kind of thing he saw his father do. Kings in the Old Testament often did exactly what they saw their father doing. Let's go again, same context. Let's drop down to verse 51. Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria. And notice verse 52, he did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father, in the way of his mother. In other words, he did exactly what he'd seen his parents do. Kings often became just like their parents. It's like their mother or their dad. We often use the phrase, actions speak louder than words. No matter what you say to your children, they're watching what you do. Children learn from what their parents do. Now, I want to tell you that many Christians have children who see some things they shouldn't see. For example, there are Christians who are raising, or their children who are raised by so-called Christians, and what they see in their parents, they see things that hinder the service of the Lord. They see things get in the way. They see missing services to travel or to visit or do other things. They see that. They recognize, you know what, we didn't attend service every time. We missed a lot of services. We were there about a third or maybe a fourth of the time, if that much. Many children of Christians see work is more important than spiritual, because quite often work gets in the way. There are children of Christians, so-called, that see little discussion about the importance of spiritual matters. They're raised to adulthood and they can look back to their childhood and say, you know what, I don't remember much spiritual discussion sitting around the family table. I don't remember mom and dad helping me with my Bible lesson. In fact, I don't remember going to Bible class much. Many children of Christians see hypocrisy. They see anger and wrath and outburst in the family. They see family troubles and marital strains. And that's what they learn about marriage in the home. They see that from their parents. It is not surprising at all when children turn out to be just like their parents trained them. Let's go to the book of Proverbs. Go with me to Proverbs, if you will, chapter 20. Proverbs 20 and in verse 7. Proverbs 20 and verse 7. The righteous man walks in his integrity, his children are blessed after him. What's the point? When a man does what is right, his children follow in that principle and they learn from that. They turn out to be just like he trained. Isn't that what Ezekiel said? Ezekiel 16:44, like mother, like daughter, that's a proverb. Like mother, like daughter, children turn out to be just like they were trained. In other words, the parents are weak, children turn out to be weak. Big surprise, big surprise. When the parents are strong spiritually, dedicated and devoted, the children often turn out to be just the same. And someone will take note, you sure are lucky your children turned out. No, it's not a matter of luck, my friend. It's a matter of work. It's a matter of work. It's not a matter of luck. When children are raised by parents who have family struggles, often they turn out to have family struggles in their own homes. When the parents are apathetic, they don't seem to care about spiritual things, the children have that same apathy. They have the same kind of problem. Let's put ourselves to the test again now. Do you remember the statement in 2 Kings and Isaiah? What have they seen in your house? What have your children been seeing in your house? What do they see in their parents? That's you. Do your children see a kind of example that they ought to follow? What kind of example are you setting? Are your children turning out to be just like you? Are you beginning to notice, you know what? They're imitating me. And the attitudes I have, I see them having. And the things I talk about is what they talk about. And the things I do is what they're beginning to do. their spirituality is a lot like mine. What if your children become just like you? Carbon copy of you. How strong will they be spiritually? Are you going to have out of your children elder material for the future? Deacons, leaders in the church, Bible class teachers, good wives? What if they become just like you? What do your children see in you? What are they seeing in you? They see hypocrisy? Do they see dedication and devotion in spiritual matters are first and foremost? Is that what they're seeing? How do we lose our children to the world? Sometimes it's not enough corrective discipline. Sometimes it's the poor example they see. And thirdly, sometimes it's because little time is spent with those children. You say, what does that have to do with anything? Well, godly parents spend time with their children. You say, how do you know that? Well, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 6. And I recognize this is the Old Testament, but this is on the verge of conquering the land and going into the land of Canaan. And Moses is preaching one of his four sermons in this 30-day period of trying to make ready for the people to conquer the land. And one of the things is we need to teach our children and the next generation to fear God, is what he's trying to tell them. And notice it, verse 7, you shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. Now, how in the world are you going to teach these diligently to your children and talk of them when you lie down and when you sit down and when you rise up if you're not spending time with your children? That's the point. What I'm suggesting is Deuteronomy 6 required them to spend some time with their children. Timothy's mother spent some time with him. Had to, because that's where he learned the scriptures. She didn't just walk through the house and say hi and bye and you're okay, do you have a good day, and then she's gone. She spent time with him. In fact, we're told to redeem the time. Make good use of your time. What better use could you make as a parent than spend some time with your children? So what I'm suggesting to you is that godly parents spend time with their children. But I want to suggest to you, it takes time to be a mom and a daddy. It takes time to do that. It takes time to be an example. It takes time to teach your children. To teach them about life. Teach them how to take care of themselves. To teach them about Scripture and teach them about God. It takes time to help them with a problem. It takes time to understand each other, for you to understand the child, where they're coming from, what's going on in their life, why they're changing, why they're having the problems they're having. It takes time to communicate with your child. It takes time to be a mom and a daddy. It takes time to build relationships that last. When you have a relationship that when they're grown and when they become adults, you have a good relationship with them. And then on your grandchildren, it comes because you spent time as a mom and a daddy with your children. I want to suggest to you, it's sad when people live together and they spend very little time together. When we do very little or nothing together, they go in separate directions. The father and the mother go in separate directions. The children go in their own direction, have little or no time with each other. They hardly have a meal together. They hardly go anywhere as a family. They never talk about each other's day. How was your day? How was things at school? How was things at work? How'd the practice go in sports today? When mom hardly teaches a daughter to do anything. How sad it is when a girl grows up and her mother hadn't taught her how to cook, how to take care of the house, how to sew or do anything. She doesn't know how to do anything because her mother didn't have time. Or when a young man grows up and he doesn't know how to change a tire on his car. And he doesn't know anything about doing anything to fix anything because dad doesn't have any time. Dad hadn't shown him a thing. How sad that is. Families that spend time, little time together, are going to have some problems. What are they? Well, number one, they're going to have a strained relationship between mom and dad, which leads to strained relationships between parent and child. Children will drift toward others that will show them attention. If dad doesn't have time for them, and you've seen this before, perhaps someone has come to you and said, dad doesn't have time for me, and they want you to spend some time. Or mom doesn't have time for me, and they want you to show them some attention. Perhaps you've had those people come to you. They'll have children that'll have little time for their parents. See, when you didn't have time for those children may not have time for you when you get old. May not have any time at all. And you'll lose your children to the world. You've seen this survey before. 1,500 children were surveyed and they were asked, what do you think makes for a happy family? And the answer was doing things together. See, it's not that expensive toy that you buy them. It's not that expensive vacation. It's not trips around the world that makes for a happy family. It's being spending time together. Graduate students at the University of Chicago were asked where they got their major ideas about morals and religion, and the number one answer was through conversation in our family at mealtime. You ever sit down to a meal together and just have conversations and talk about applications of principles, of morals and spirituality? We do. This is why we said no. This is why we did that. Here's why. Good teaching opportunities is Deuteronomy 6. Let's put ourselves to the test again. How much time do you spend with your children? How much time are you spending with your children? Do your children ask to do things, you to do things with them and then you don't have time? Children never ask you to do something like even just throw a ball. Or let's go ride a bike and you never have time. Will your children have memories of things you did together? When they grow up, will they say, you know, I remember mom and dad doing this. I remember us going as a family. I remember us doing things as a family. I remember that. Are they going to have memories of that? Do you go places and do things as a family? Or is dad with his friends and mom's with her friends and the kids are off with their friends and they never are together as a family? Do you take time to have meals together? Just sit around the table and have a meal together. Do you take time to do that? Do you take time to teach everyday things to your children? Not just Bible things, but just teach everyday things. How to live life, how to take care of themselves, how to function in life. Do you take time to teach your children? Do your children think you're too busy for them to ask you something? To make a request because they know you're just too busy? You ain't got time for them. How are we doing with our time and our children? Why are we losing our children to the world? Not enough corrective discipline, poor example they see, little time together. But a fourth reason is there's little communication sometimes between parent and the children. Little communication. Effective communication, I might add. Now, some responsibilities we cannot fulfill without effective communication. Let's go back to Proverbs 22 and in verse 6. Train a child in the way that he should go. How can you do that unless you communicate with the child? There's got to be some communication. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You can't do that without communication. For example, Proverbs 29 and verse 15, the rod and reproof give instruction, give correction. That is, not only does there need to be some correction, but there needs to be some instruction. So rebuke and instruction needs to be given to the child. You cannot do that without some kind of effective communication. Let's define communication. By communication, it is not simply yelling at the child. There are parents who yell at their children and they scream at their children and they fuss and there's constant criticism and they're constantly harping at their children and they think they have communicated. That's not communication. It's not effective communication at least. What does it involve? It involves talking to your child. And you say, what is Matthew 7? I don't remember that in Matthew. Matthew 7 is the golden rule, verse 12. As you would that men do to you, do even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Treat others the way you want to be treated. How did you want to be treated when you were a child? Did you want your parents to talk to you? And do you want your children to talk to you? Well, then there needs to be some talking. Not yelling, not screaming, not fussing, not complaining. There'd be some talking. Same verse, there needs to be some listening. Do you want your children to listen to you? Did you want your parents to listen to you? There needs to be some listening to them. Even when you disagree with them, you need to listen to one another. There needs to be some calm discussion. Let's go to Proverbs 15 and in verse 1. Calm discussion. That is, even when there's disagreement, even when there is a rebuke, even when there is a discipline issue, there needs to be some calm discussion. Proverbs 15 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Why does sometimes the parent-child communication sometimes get into a shouting match between them? It's because someone didn't understand that a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Same book, Proverbs. Let's go to the 29th division. Look at verse 22. An angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression. When you're angry, you stir up more problems. So you approach the child with anger and yelling and you're screaming. The next thing you know, the child is all upset, and now this communication is completely broken down. That happens time and again. Problems are created when communication fails because there's little or no bonding between the parent and the child. Little or no influence or impact. You say, why don't my children listen to me? Because you haven't communicated, perhaps. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 4. Quite often we provoke them to wrath. Let's talk about that passage. Here's the passage. You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. The text is not saying, don't do anything that makes your children angry. You say, well, I'm going to spank you. Well, that makes me angry. You can't do that, Dad. The child asks to do something, you say, well, no, you can't do it. That'll make me angry. Better let me go. That's not saying don't make them angry. What is this text talking about? It is a contrast to bringing them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. Read the text again. You fathers, do not provoke them up to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. When I'm bringing them up in the training and admonition of the Lord, I am not provoking them to wrath. When I'm provoking them to wrath, I'm not bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Just to contrast one to the other. Now, Barnes made this observation. He said, provoke not your children to wrath. He's a commentator, I recognize that, but he says something worth our consideration. He said, that is by unreasonable commands. Let's stop there. He's making some application of the principle. You make unreasonable commands, you're provoking your child to wrath. You say, this is what you're going to do, and it's something they can't do. It's unreasonable for them to accomplish that, maybe in the short time or whatever the case may be, and now you're provoking them to wrath. By needless severity, by manifestation of anger, those are ways in which we might provoke them to wrath. So govern them and so punish them, if punishment is necessary, that they do not lose their confidence in you, but shall love you. The apostle here is hit at a very danger to which parents are most exposed in the government of their children. It is that of souring their temper, of making them feel that the parent is under the influence of anger, and that is right for them to be so too. Barnes hit a nerve there. Let's put ourselves to the test. How well do you communicate with your children? How well? Are you communicating well with them? Are they listening to you? Can you talk and discuss problems with your children? I don't mean yell and shout, but can you calmly talk? Can you resolve differences with your children without anger? Can you do that? Do you listen to your child's point of view? Even though it may be immature, even though you may disagree, can you get there to and understand that point of view? That's part of communication. If your child had a problem, would they more likely come to talk to you or go to someone else? Wouldn't that be disheartening that your child went to someone else because they felt like they couldn't come and talk to you? They went to someone else. Maybe a teacher at school or maybe a friend because they felt like they couldn't talk with you about that problem. How well are we doing with communication? How do we lose our children to the world? It may be the friends they hang out with. It may be the friends they hang out with. Close friends draw close together. That's the nature of close friends. And quite often we become just like the friends. You recognize that in your own life, in your own friendship. Let's go to Psalm 1. You are familiar with Psalm 1, verses 1 to 3. It talks about close associations and the influence they have. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scornful. Now notice what he says in verse 1. He walks in the counsel of the ungodly. The man who walks in the counsel of the ungodly is more apt then to walk in the stand in the path of sinners and then is more apt to sit in the seat of the scornful? How did it all start? By listening to the counsel of the ungodly. You see, we become like those that we are around. Galatians chapter 2, you remember the case of the hypocrisy of Peter, and here's two things I want you to see. Peter was influenced by those he was with. Peter knew better than to act like this. He knew better than to refuse association with the Gentiles, but because of some that he was with and those that he was around, he was influenced to do what he knew to be wrong. That wasn't the only problem. Barnabas was influenced by Peter. And we can be influenced by those that we're around. Close friends draw close and we become like them. There are a number of warnings in the scriptures that warn against our associations. Let's go to Proverbs again. Let's go to Proverbs 12 and in verse 26. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. Be careful who your friends are, because they can lead you in the wrong direction. That's a warning. Let's go to the same book, book of Proverbs, chapter 4 this time, in verse 14 beginning. Do not enter in the path of the wicked, and do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not travel it. Turn away from it and pass on. For they do not sleep unless they have done evil. That's enough to get our point. Don't associate with those that are evil. Don't run with them. Don't make them your intimate companions, because they're going in the wrong direction. That's the warning. Let's go to chapter 22. This one is the most fascinating passage. You've heard me talk about this many times, because of what it says and what it doesn't say. And that is, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go. Don't be close friends with somebody who is given to anger. And you say, well, what's the big problem? That's not immoral. It's not like they're homosexual. It's not like they're a drunkard. It's not like they're an idolater. Not like they're an adulterer. Not like they're a porn person. This is an angry person. So don't make friends with an angry person. Look at verse 25. Lest you learn his ways and he set a snare for your soul. In other words, you become like those that are around you. Evil communications, Paul said, 1 Corinthians 15, corrupts good manners, good morals. There's two passages on the screen before you. We've already looked at Psalm 1. I want to go to Psalm 106, if you will. Let's talk about the possibility of what could happen. Turn to Psalm 106. This is a historical psalm. Look beginning at verse 34. Psalm 106 and verse 34. Talks about how the children of Israel did not drive out the Canaanites, so they didn't destroy the people. In other words, they associated with the world. Now notice it, verse 35, but they mingled with the Gentiles and became friends with them, became intimate with them, got to know them quite well. And they learned their works, and then they served their idols, even going so far as sacrificing their own children. What I want you to see is the progression into sin. They began to be close associates. They didn't separate themselves from the world, became close associates. They learned from them, and then they started doing what they were doing. See, when our children have friends of the world, here's what could happen. They could become indifferent towards sin and not bothered by it. See, if they have friends that are doing things that are contrary to the will of God, they may get so familiar with that, they become indifferent, and they're not bothered by that sin. They're not doing it yet, but they're just not bothered by that sin anymore. That may lead to a little participation, maybe a little drinking, a little smoking, maybe some drugs, some bad language, some watching some filth. Oh, not a lot, but just a little bit. Becoming desensitized. That could then lead to hypocrisy, where we try to hold a hand to God and at the same time hold a hand to the world, and we're trying to hold everybody's hand at the same time. That's hypocrisy. That easily could lead to more participation in sin, and now we're less bothered than we were before. And then that could lead to less concern about God, less concern about the church, and less concern about God's word. And now that we're disinterested at all with spiritual things, and we wonder, scratch our heads and wonder, how in the world did they get involved in the world? Let's put ourselves to the test again. What rules do you have for your children and their friends? Do you let your children just choose whoever they want, and you say, you just spend whatever time you want, wherever you want to go? You want to go spend the night with them, spend the day with them, go spend some time, and they can come and spend time with you? Or do you have rules about your children's friends? Do you have rules? You're the parent, by the way. You make rules. What rules do you have? Do you know who your children's friends are? Do you know anything about them? About their parents? You paying attention to that? Do you know where your children are and who they're with? Or you know they're out with a group, but do you know who they're with? Do you know who's influencing your children? Do you know anything about that? Do you know your children? Do you think your children will not be influenced by their friends? You say, well, I know they've got friends that drink, but my children wouldn't be influenced by that. I know they curse, but my children wouldn't be influenced by that. And I know they do things that are ungodly. They're immoral, but they would not be influenced by that at all. Really? You think Psalms 106 is wrong? You think maybe 1 Corinthians 15 is wrong? Think they wouldn't be influenced by that? Do you see a change in your child's behavior when they're around a certain friend? Have you noticed this certain friend makes them a little more cocky, makes them a little more rebellious, makes them a little more defiant? Have you noticed that around certain friends? Maybe you need to be paying attention as a parent. One more time, let's go and answer this question. How do we lose our children to the world? And one of the reasons is we're lacking spiritual emphasis in the home. Lacking spiritual emphasis in the home. You see, children should be raised in a home with dedication and devotion, where we put spiritual things first. In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. First and foremost above everything else is for God to rule in our hearts. That spiritual matters first. Deuteronomy chapter 4, this is in Moses' first sermon, as we talked about a moment ago. Let's go to the fourth chapter now, beginning at verse 9. He said, only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and to your grandchildren. Now notice at verse 10, at the end of the verse, that they should learn to fear the Lord all the days that they live on the earth. We should be teaching our children, and they should be raised in a home that fears God, where we put spiritual things first, where we're governed and make decisions by the Word of God. Look at Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27. Paul said, our conversation needs to be as it becometh the gospel of Christ. In other words, all decisions, and we are governed by what the Word of God has to say. Imagine the influence that a child would have if they're raised in a home where spiritual things are first, fear of God is second to nothing, and we fear God, and that causes us then to govern everything by what the Word of God has to say. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. I want to look at some things in the context. Here is where a passage describes the spiritual influence, the spiritual emphasis is in the home. Notice in verse 1, first of all, that spiritual emphasis is where there is the fear and the trust in God. Here is a woman who has a husband that's not a Christian, but he observes her chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Look at verse 5, that these as women of old trusted in God. Here is a home where there is fear and trust in God. Secondly, there's concern about the souls of those in the family. This woman of verse 1 and 2 is concerned about her husband because he's not a Christian, and she wants to do everything she can to bring him to Christ. That even means she keeps her mouth shut, which is what he says at verse 2. Thirdly, she lives a pure life. Here's a godly home where there is purity of life. They observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. And furthermore, the focus is on the inward and not the outward. Look at verse 3. The adorning is not the outward arranging of the hair, the wearing of gold, or putting on apparel, but the hidden person of the heart. Where the emphasis in the home is on the inner man, that is the spiritual side of man, the inward life, rather than how we look on the outside. And furthermore, we're concerned about things that hinder our influence and hinder our spirituality before God. Verse 7. Now, when spiritual is not the emphasis, children learn spiritual is secondary. You see, children sometimes are raised in a home where they recognize, spiritual is important, but it becomes secondary to other things. And faith will not be strong in those children. And they may lose what faith they have when they leave home. We're not greatly surprised sometimes when children are raised and it seems like their faith that they had is getting weaker and weaker, and then they leave home and they don't have any faith at all. Because maybe the spiritual wasn't emphasized. They learned to not let spiritual things get in the way of what they want to do. Because mom and dad didn't let the spiritual get in the way. We wanted to do things as a family. We wanted vacation. We wanted to have fun. And we wanted sports. And that never got in the way. Spirituality never got in the way of what we wanted to do. And children learn that. Let's put ourselves to the test one more time. How do spiritual matters rank in your home? When you're dead and gone, would your children say, you know what I remember about mom and dad is spiritual matters were top and foremost, and they were number one in our home, in our family? it always was. Is that what they're going to say? How do spiritual matters rank in your home? Do your children know that you will never let anything interfere with the spiritual? In other words, you know not to go to mom and dad. Do they know not to go to mom and dad and ask, can we do this Wednesday night? Or on Sunday, instead of going to church, can we? They know not to ask because they know you'll never let anything interfere. Do your children see hindrances that you allow? That you allow this hindrance and then that hindrance, but then you keep telling them about how important spiritual things are? Do your children think some things are more important than the spiritual? Do they think their job's more important? Their education is more important? Do they think family's more important? Where'd they get that idea? We've been talking this morning about how we lose our children to the world. How is it that happens? Well, sometimes when there's not enough corrective discipline. Or maybe it's by the poor example they see. Or maybe it's because of the little time we spend with them as parents. Or maybe it's the little communication that we have. Or maybe it's because of the friends they hang out with. Or maybe it's because of the lack of spiritual emphasis in the home. Any one or all of those could contribute to the downfall of our children. And then we lose our children to the world. Remember we started on the note of a lost child? How tragic. The tears that are shed. More tragic than that is when we lose our children to the world. We lost them to Satan and they lose their soul because of the failure of us as parents. May God help us as we raise our children, that we raise them to walk in the fear of God. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism? And would you come while together we stand and while we sing?